This episode's audio was generated using AI technology.
You know, there is this this fundamental tension in engineering that I think about all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
Like on a whiteboard, you can design a perfectly frictionless vacuum. The math is beautiful. The logic is pristine. You draw an engine and it operates at absolute maximum efficiency because, well, on the board, there is no air resistance.
Right. The theoretical design is flawless. But then physical reality demands compromises. Suddenly you need grease, you need tolerance gaps, heat sinks, or the whole thing just vibrates itself to pieces.
Exactly. Engineers like things clean, but production environments are inherently dirty.
Yeah.
And you'd think software engineering escapes this because it's just code, right? It's virtual.
You would think so, yeah.
But the moment you take pure theoretical computer science and try to execute it in a gritty production environment, that friction is everywhere. So welcome to another episode of Kernel Panic. Today, we are exploring that exact collision.
It's such a fascinating topic.
It really is. And we're pulling from a wild mix of materials to do it. We've got documentation from SWI Prologue on single-sided unification, some really intense Stack Overflow debates about infinite recursion, an infamous manifesto called Prologue Coding Horror, architectural guidelines from LMDA, and Jeff Atwood's classic piece on programming for others.
It's a great stack of sources because, you know, while we are going to get super deep into the mechanics of Prologue's logic resolution, the ultimate lesson here is much broader. I mean, it's really about the human side of shipping maintainable code.
Right, regardless of the language you use. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with a brain teaser from those Stack Overflow threads that perfectly illustrates this friction. What happens if you try to unify a variable with a term that contains itself?
Oh, right.
Like in code, imagine typing fxx.
So in pure mathematical logic, unification is about making two terms identical by binding variables.
Right.
But x is a strict subterm of fx. You can't make a box identical to a box that already contains itself. Logically, it's a paradox. It should instantly fail.
But if you actually type fxx into a standard Prologue interpreter, it often doesn't fail. It spits back f of fff into infinity.
Yeah, it literally creates an infinite tree in your memory until the system crashes.
Wait, why on earth does it do that?
It basically comes down to a deliberate compiler trade-off. To remain logically sound, the interpreter needs to perform an occurs check before every single unification.
An occurs check.
Right. It has to scan the entire term to ensure a variable isn't binding to a structure containing itself.
Yeah.
But checking that every single time is... it's computationally expensive. It turns a lightning fast O1 operation into an ON operation where N is the size of the term.
Oh, wow.
So historically, most Prologue implementations just skipped the occurs check by default.
So it's lying to us for speed. It's like a C compiler dropping array bounds checking because validating memory takes too many cycles. It's like asking a spell checker to validate a dictionary, but it just assumes it's fine because reading the whole thing would hold up the line. If the language is lying to us to save time, isn't that a massive trap for a programmer?
It is a huge trap, which is why modern systems usually offer a way to enforce it, like using the ISO predicate unify with curse check. But it highlights the core tension perfectly. Pure logic demanded the check, but production efficiency demands skipping it.
Right, so the language sacrifices theoretical soundness for execution speed.
Yes, leaving the burden of safety entirely on the developer.
So if the compiler won't protect our system from generating these infinite trees, how do we protect ourselves? Because one of the Stack Overflow threads we looked at attempts to tackle this by writing a Prologue meta interpreter that guarantees halting.
Yeah, that's a wild thread.
They basically want an interpreter that uses depth-first search, but absolutely will not get stuck in an infinite recursion loop.
Right, and this touches on some really deep complexity theory. The moment you demand a mathematical guarantee that a program will halt, you have to sacrifice Turing completeness.
Wait, what?
By definition, you cannot solve the halting problem for a Turing complete language.
Okay, so if we are intentionally breaking Turing completeness just to guarantee a program halts, aren't we neutering the language? Like, what does that actually mean in practice?
Well, the sources discuss using these things called reduction orders for termination proofs. Essentially, you map the complexity or the size of a term to a well-founded relation, like the natural numbers.
Okay.
And then you mathematically prove that every single step of your recursive loop strictly reduces the size of the problem.
So I'm simply not allowed to have a function call a similarly complex version of itself. I have to prove I'm stripping away data on every single pass.
Yes. You enforce what's called universal termination, or at least existential termination, where you prove that at least one branch of your logic will strictly reduce and eventually bottom out.
But proving mathematical reduction at compile time for every piece of code is exhausting. The source offers a practical workaround, right?
It does, yeah.
They talk about building a circular meta-interpreter that tracks visited clause branches, or using something called XSB tabling to memoize the states. Unpack that for me. How does memoizing stop an infinite loop?
So memoization, or tabling in this context, is essentially aggressive caching of the solver's state. Imagine you ask a system to calculate the 50th number in the Fibonacci sequence.
That is the classic example.
Without caching, it recalculates the same smaller numbers millions of times, creating this massive execution tree. With tabling, the moment it calculates the 10th number, it writes the answer down.
Ah, I see.
If the program tries to evaluate that exact same logical state again, the interpreter intercepts it. It says, I already know the answer to this. Or, more importantly, for infinite loops, it says, I am already in the middle of evaluating this exact state, so stop going down this path.
Wow, so it cuts off the loop because it recognizes it's running in circles.
Yeah.
Okay, tabling sounds incredibly useful, but caching every state has to require massive amounts of memory. What if I want to manually prune the search tree to save memory?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, this brings us to the ultimate and probably most controversial tool in logic programming. The cut operator. It's represented by an exclamation point.
The cut operator is incredibly powerful and honestly heavily debated. Prolog works by searching a tree of possibilities. If option A fails, it backtracks and tries option B.
Right.
The cut essentially tells the interpreter, commit to all the choices you've made so far in this specific rule and do not backtrack. Throw away option B. It violently prunes the search tree.
But our sources are careful to distinguish between two distinct types of cuts, right? Green cuts and red cuts.
Yes, that distinction is crucial.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's break those down. A green cut improves efficiency by pruning fruitless computational paths without changing the declarative meaning of the program.
Exactly. If you remove a green cut from your code, the program still gives the exact same correct answers. It just might take a lot longer or use more memory to search paths that were destined to fail anyway.
Okay, so what about a red cut?
A red cut actually prunes away valid solutions that might otherwise be there. It changes the program's truth. It's often used for negation by failure, where you basically say, if this condition is met, succeed and cut, otherwise fail.
So let me try an analogy here. A green cut is like trimming dead branches off a tree so it grows faster, but a red cut is like chopping down the trunk and painting it green.
Yeah.
You are fundamentally altering the reality of the search space.
That captures the danger perfectly. Many purists argue that red cuts are procedural artifacts shoved roughly into a declarative language. They destroy the logical purity of the code.
Isn't a red cut basically just a hacky, dangerous go-to statement for logic programmers?
Pretty much. In pure logic, AANDB should be the same as BANDA. But if you simply reorder your clauses in a program containing a red cut, it will suddenly behave completely differently. It completely breaks commutativity.
So what happens when an entire production system is built out of these locked doors? I want to pivot to the manifesto titled Prolog Coding Horror. It looks at the fallout when these low-level hacks hit massive code bases.
Yeah. The author points out that an acceptably efficient terminating program really only has two major ways to be defective.
Which are?
First, it can report wrong answers. Second, it can lose intended solutions, meaning it fails to report a correct answer that actually exists in the logic.
A source makes a fascinating argument that losing solutions is actually the much worse defect. Put yourself in the shoes of a maintainer at 2 a.m. If my application generates a blatantly wrong answer, that seems catastrophic. Why exactly is losing a solution considered worse than generating a blatantly wrong answer?
It all comes down to system observability. A wrong answer is noisy, it breaks a unit test, it outputs garbage to a UI, a user complains. You can see it, track it down, and fix it.
That makes sense.
Losing a solution, however, is a silent failure. It happens when developers use impure, non-monotonic constructs like the cut or the arrow operator or checking if a variable is unbound using var1.
And they just fail silently.
Right. These tools quietly prune away valid logical states without throwing an error. Silent failures destroy reliability because the system keeps running, quietly poisoning downstream databases or failing to trigger critical alerts, and you don't realize it until the corruption is deeply embedded.
The manifesto lists other horrors that create these unmaintainable systems. One that jumped out at me is modifying global state using asserts and retract. Wait, what do those actually do in practice? Yes,
they allow the code to rewrite its own source code during execution. Asserts dynamically inserts a new logical rule into the database at runtime, and retract removes one.
That sounds like a debugging nightmare. You're dealing with self-modifying code where the rules of reality change depending on exactly what millisecond a function executed.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. It introduces implicit, unforced dependencies. If your predicates run in a different order than you anticipated, the global state is completely scrambled, and the logic breaks in ways that are nearly impossible to trace.
Yikes.
And the source also highlights the horror of impure output. This is when a developer prints text directly to the terminal from deep within a logical evaluation instead of letting the top level evaluate pure relations and return the result.
Because you can't write a unit test for text that just flashes on a screen and vanishes from the program's memory.
Exactly.
So how do we fix a system where logical purity is being sabotaged by these procedural hacks? This brings us to SWI Prolog's documentation on single-sided unification, or SSU, uses this arrow operator to build rules.
Right. SSU is a brilliant architectural fix for this tension. Traditionally, if you wanted to write procedural code in Prolog, you needed immense discipline. You had to follow strict rules.
Like what?
Like putting the cut as early as possible to commit the choice and avoiding head unification that binds values in the goal term. If you bound variables in the head of your rule, you lost what it's called steadfastness.
Okay, let's pause on steadfastness. That means a function should return the same logical truth, regardless of whether you pass it an unbound variable to solve for or a hard-coded value to check, right?
Yes. If a predicate isn't steadfast, it might succeed when it logically shouldn't. Imagine calling a max function. If it isn't steadfast, the internal mechanics might bind variables in a way that evaluates a nonsense statement as true.
I see.
SSU elegantly solves this by separating the evaluation process.
Yeah, and it does this using the operator instead of the traditional neck operator.
Right. When you use, the system executes a guard condition after a single-sided unification match. Only if that guard succeeds does the system commit to the rule, automatically placing a cut behind the scenes.
Okay.
It verifies the types and states without inappropriately binding variables, and the language handles the dangerous commitment mechanics safely.
So by introducing the operator, aren't we just making Prolog look and act like every other procedural language? Doesn't that defeat the purpose?
I get why you'd ask that, but it actually protects the logic. By explicitly demarcating procedural code with inhibition, you stop it from polluting your pure relational code. You are turning those terrifying silent failures on type errors into loud, visible, debuggable errors.
Your server might throw an exception, but at least your 2 a.m. maintainer gets a stack trace instead of a silent data loss.
Exactly.
Well, let's zoom out. Whether we use loud SSU guards or green cuts or carefully avoid the occurs check, managing this requires immense discipline. How do you systematize this across a massive code base?
That's the real challenge.
I want to pull from the LMDA slides on software engineering and specification documentation. They emphasize that strict specifications are the only way forward.
Yeah, they outline a really rigorous specification format. You can't just write a function. You must strictly define the name, the arity, which is the number of arguments, the types, and crucially, the modes of use.
The modes of use. That's using a plus sign for inputs and a minus sign for outputs before and after the call. Explain why that's so important here.
In a purely relational logic program, an argument could be an input or an output depending on how you query it. You can literally run the program backward.
Right.
You can ask what two lists append together to make this final list. But in a production environment, you usually have an intended direction of data flow. Documenting that, clearly specifying that these two arguments must be fully instantiated inputs, and this one will be the output, is essential.
This reminds me of Jeff Atwood's blog post in our sources about object happiness and what he calls POO programming for others.
Oh, that's a classic.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Atwood points out that developers often fall prey to object happiness, slavishly adhering to object-oriented design principles. They build massive inheritance hierarchies and abstract base classes for trivial projects just to feel intellectually productive.
It's a huge problem.
And I'd argue logic programmers suffer from logic happiness, writing impossibly dense, hyper-pure mathematical relations that are theoretically beautiful, but completely unreadable to the next engineer who inherits the system.
Oh, absolutely.
PO is about empathy. It's like leaving well-lit exit signs in a burning building for the next developer. Is it fair to say that slavish adherence to object-oriented programming, or even pure logical programming, is just an ego trip if you forget the human who has to read your code?
I completely agree. Code is read far more often than it is written. If your architecture obscures the intent of the program to prove how clever you are, you have failed as an engineer. The mechanisms we discussed, like those strict LMDA specs, they're all tools of empathy.
So if the dirty 1980s hacks like red cuts were bad, and purely abstract math is unreadable, where does the industry go from here? Our final source looks at the future of Prolog.
The future is actually looking to the past, but executing it with modern tooling. The historical frustration with Prolog came from teaching it with those low-level, impure 1980s hacks. The goal now is to return to a pure monotonic subset of the language.
Hold on, what actually makes a logic subset monotonic?
A logic system is monotonic if adding new facts to your database cannot invalidate conclusions you have already drawn. In standard Prolog, if you use a red cut or retractor rule, a statement that was true a microsecond ago suddenly becomes false.
Right, the self-modifying code problem.
Exactly. That destroys monotonicity. Sticking to a pure subset guarantees that your truth remains stable, which makes scaling and concurrent execution possible.
What does working in that subset mean practically for an engineer today?
It means relying on modern declarative tools like CLP, FD, constraint logic programming over finite domains.
Okay, how does that work?
Instead of using low-level procedural arithmetic to test if an integer works, you define the mathematical constraints of the domain up front. The engine algebraically narrows down the possibilities before it ever starts searching.
Oh, wow. So it's vastly safer and faster.
It is. It also involves using answer set programming, or ASP, where you describe constraints purely and let the solver handle the execution path entirely.
And the tooling is finally catching up to make this performant without the old hacks. The source mentions advancements in Scryer Prolog representing strings compactly as lists of characters, and Chirala Prolog using map system calls. Explain how MIC is this logic C-like performance.
So when you use map, you are asking the operating system to map a file directly into the application's memory space, bypassing the usual expensive read and write buffers.
Yeah.
This allows Prolog's definite clause grammars, its parsing engine, to scan gigabytes of text directly from the disk. It doesn't have to load the entire file into a massive variable first. You get zero copy memory access with the logical purity of mathematical parsing.
Which eliminates the need for all the procedural workarounds that caused the coding horrors in the first place. We've covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the weird paradoxes of the occurs check, where the compiler drops its boundaries just to save CPU cycles.
We did.
We navigated the stack pruning dangers of the cut, the nightmare of self-modifying code, and we arrived at the realization that the best architecture, whether logical, procedural, or object-oriented, is fundamentally built on empathy for the maintainer.
It all comes back to that initial friction. The whiteboard design is a powerful starting point, but deploying it safely requires disciplined, empathetic engineering.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to ponder. Think about the most frustrating, inexplicable bug you tackled this week. Was it really a failure of your architecture? Or is it possible that somewhere deep in your stack, your framework's equivalent of an occurs check was quietly turned off for efficiency? And it's been silently lying to you this whole time.
And remember that frictionless vacuum we talked about at the start. It doesn't exist in software. You have to design for the dirt.
Thanks for joining another episode of Kernel Panic. Keep your code pure and your cuts green.